now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today it's all about pressure and glory as Liverpool edge past Chelsea to win the Carabao Cup. The pressure is also back on Erik ten Hag after defeat against Fulham, and it was a glorious Saturday for Arsenal and Crystal Palace. We'll also be chatting scraps on the pitch and finding out which manager described playing Brentford as like visiting the dentist. And joining me for all that, we've got two of the most glorious football writers in the land, Alison Rudd and Tom Allnutt, and a former footballer who knows a thing or two about pressure, having scored the winning penalty in a shootout in the final of the prestigious Dallas Cup in 2002 for Nottingham Forest's under-19s. Gregor Robertson, how have you kept this from us? How have we got to nearly March without this being the best fact about your career?
That's your research, Tom.
The winning pen.
Yes. I mean, I didn't ever think I'd be on here talking about a winning penalty kick in a youth tournament. It was a prestigious tournament, you're right. We went to the final, played Dallas, the hosts in the final, yeah, and stepped up.
So were you
fifth pen.
Bloody hell,
I always picked fifth, yeah. Sometimes I didn't get one, that meant I didn't get one, but
you always fancied yourself as fifth. Alison, yeah. I'm shocked, aren't you? I didn't see this in his locker at all.
He's icy cold.
Those kind of chats about, you know, not laying the ball back and racked with self-doubt.
Oh, come on, that was once. That was just like, that was a little insight into the mindset.
You fancied yourself as fifth penalty taker.
Do you know what?
Where did you go? Top bin?
Yeah, top right. But I always remember, I didn't see it hit the net. I knew it was in and I turned away and like...
You turned away before you even saw it go in?
It's the truth. There's not been many, you know, I didn't take many penalty kicks, but I do remember that. Just putting it to that side, I didn't have to look. I was in.
You knew you'd won it.
It was like Van Dijk. Everybody was swarming on top of me. Great memories, Tom. Thanks for bringing that up.
This pen's a bit of a grey area, isn't it? Because sometimes it's the one that you really rely on, and sometimes maybe it's the one that you're sort of hoping doesn't have to take one. Which one were you?
Yeah, I don't know why I always picked the fifth. I think I did go for, I probably just wanted the glory. But you're right, it could be the pressure. I did get the glory, though, so it worked out in the end.
Amazing. Well, there you go. From one defender with a moment of glory in a final to another. And Virgil van Dijk and his winner for Liverpool. Now, on Thursday's show, Gregor and Martin and James Gearbrand hinted that this game might be 0-0, while I fought back and said it was going to be a thriller, which just goes to show listeners that you can both be right, because it was an incredibly good game, I thought, whilst also finishing 0-0 in normal time. Now, we've got a Liverpool fan in here as well as a journalist who was there in Tom Allnutt. So, Gregor, I'm going to start with you with a simple question. Do Liverpool deserve to win?
Yes.
That pause was slightly too long, wasn't it?
It's quite long.
They did. I mean, look, if you look at the XG and you look at how many... Probably the quality of the chances created, Chelsea probably edged it. But for the kind of... All the traits that ultimately win you tournaments and make you successful, like the fight and the hunger and the drive and all the sort of wonder of seeing these kids step off the bench and, you know, play a part.
So you're saying they deserved it from a narrative point of view, not necessarily the footballing side?
Both. But narrative's part of it. Narrative influenced the game. I think you saw...
Yeah, well, now we know you're an egomaniac who goes to the fifth penalty kick. We know that.
It influences the game. You saw them come on and they had the energy and you saw Chelsea wilt. And it's not because of the names on their back or the ridiculously high numbers on their shirts. It's because they had energy and fearlessness. And that can always be a bit of a cliche. You know, think, why, you know, what does fearlessness mean? It just means they haven't messed up enough to play with caution. The fear is a lack of caution. That's what it is, really. And there was a moment in extra time where I think it was O'Connell. He got the ball from the goalkeeper and turned in between two Chelsea midfielders, like, and raced through the centre of the pitch. And you just thought, like, or even when Gerald Kwanzaa came on, and his first touch, slightly too heavy at his feet, and he was being closed down, and he just chopped inside. I think it was maybe Cole Palmer. Just like, that was fearlessness.
Yeah.
So all of that, I think, contributed to Liverpool deserving to win this game.
We'll come back to the kids and some of that fearlessness a bit later. But Tom, you were there at Wembley. Would you agree with Gregor's assessment?
I don't know, you know. I mean, I thought Liverpool were much the better team in the first kind of half an hour. But in the second half, I really thought that substitution they had to make earlier when Gravenberch went off injured, and they basically had to make three changes, push Bradley up, you know, further forward. Gomez came in at right back. Elliot then dropped into midfield, you know, and suddenly the team, I just thought, didn't quite gel there. And you could see that Liverpool were suddenly a bit more disjointed. And I actually thought in the second half, I thought there in the stadium, it felt like to me like Chelsea were going to win it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? We were discussing yesterday because I was editing and we were talking about potential pieces, and you were talking about maybe writing about Chelsea's midfield and Enzo, and you actually came back and said, hang on, I think Chelsea are going to win, so let's not get carried away with whatever topic.
Because in the first half, it felt like Liverpool were going to win, so it felt like you were going to write something maybe, you know, to do with Chelsea defeat. But increasingly in the second half, I felt in the stadium, and Paul Joyce sitting next to me, we both felt that Chelsea were gaining in belief, gaining momentum. They created some really good chances, you know, and actually...
Towards the end of the game as well, there were moments.
Towards the end of the game, yeah. And I mean, Gallagher had two really good ones. Yeah. I can't remember if that was extra time or the second half. And Pochettino afterwards, I think his real disappointment was with how Chelsea played an extra time, you know, because I think he felt that they had the game where they wanted. It was right in their grasp. And that actually in extra time, they kind of let Liverpool back in. And whether that was a psychological thing, because suddenly Liverpool were playing all these kids and they thought, blimey, we could lose this against a bunch of reserves. Or whether it was a fitness thing, I don't know. But they had it.
He said also that they looked like they were playing for penalties a little bit.
He said they looked like they were playing for penalties, yeah. And he sort of said... I don't know if that was a mentality thing or a fitness thing, but it did feel like Liverpool with a better team in extra time. But I actually thought in the second half, I thought Chelsea came on strong, and there wasn't much in it. It was a funny game. It kind of went backwards and forwards, and that was why it was so entertaining to watch, because there were chances for both teams. I mean, I guess overall, you'd probably say maybe Liverpool just about deserved to win it. But if it had gone to penalties and Chelsea had won, I don't think anyone would have said that was a robbery, you know. Mm. Personally, that's not how I saw it. I mean, it's interesting the fearless thing, because I was sort of looking at it and thinking, if this goes to penalties, Liverpool haven't got Alisson, and they've got a bunch of 18-year-olds here. Like, and it felt to me maybe in the penalty shootout, I don't know, this is where the kind of fearless thing versus the sort of nervousness comes in. I mean, you know, the penalty shootout, Gregor, maybe you can tell me, like, is it as a kid, are you better off taking a penalty, or are you?
I mean, that would have been a huge moment for anyone who had taken it. But you're absolutely right. You look through Liverpool's team, you thought, who's going to take penalty kicks here? But Gallagher was brilliant. He was outstanding in the game. Made some great saves. And that one where he raced off his line to block Conor Gallagher as well. Huge moments. He had some huge moments in the game.
And that save in the first half to Palmer, wasn't it? When he had the 6-7 yards out.
Yeah.
It was a great save.
Yeah.
Well, we've held her off as long as we could. We talked about the game in a rounded way, but we have to come to Alison Rudd, and I'm going to do so in a nice way, because I'm going to, before we hear from you today, we're going to hear from you last week on a certain Liverpool player.
You have to meet the man to realise what an impact he probably has as captain of that team. He has the hugest of auras, but he just exudes calm and seriousness, and You can imagine being in the dressing room or walking out with him and having concerns about whatever the concerns might be, too many young players in the team perhaps, and him being able to convince everybody, don't worry, we've got this.
The him, of course, being Virgil van Dijk. Alison, you said it all already before he even steps up, with those worries about those young kids. Now, I wanted to leap off that point and talk about Virgil van Dijk, but also get your view as a Liverpool fan. Watching that game, were you in camp Van Dijk, what a hero, what a colossal leader of men? Or were you in camp, God, we've got loads of kids, aren't they brilliant? Pick one.
Oh, well, Virgil camp, if I have to pick one.
If you have to pick one.
They're not mutually exclusive.
They're not.
But if I'm going to be completely honest, which I always am on this podcast, and I probably shouldn't be, but I did spend the game, watched it as a family, and I did spend the game saying quite a lot, it's okay, Virgil. It's okay, Virgil's on the pitch. It's okay. Because my son had...
I'm going to need your son to ratify that as well, I think.
My youngest son had quoted, in a taking the piss sense, a tweet. I'd retweeted a clip from the podcast from last week. And also, I think I'd retweeted a piece from my Liverpool Report last week, in which the clip that was put on the tweet was, the sky could fall in or something and Virgil van Dijk would remain completely calm. And so my son read this out from his phone in a sort of piss-takey, mum, you go over the top, too much sort of way. But I kept quoting it back to him during the match. I was saying, you see, it doesn't matter that everything's gone wrong injury-wise for Liverpool. It doesn't matter they're without Mo Salah, without Darwin Nunes, without a decent midfield. It doesn't matter because Virgil's there. Look at him. Just look at him. And it felt, and it did indeed unfold like that. So he scored twice, once disallowed. And it did feel like there was a majesty to the goal. So it felt very natural. I accept everything Thomas said about Chelsea having periods where they played well. But they were never looked magisterial, ever. And Van Dijk brought majesty to the Liverpool team. The best line written all Sunday was from Tom Allnutt, where he said there were moments when Van Dijk looked like an uncomfortable dad at a stag do because they were so young around him. And it was slightly incongruous, that level of majesty compared to these very young kids with very little first team experience. It's not their age necessarily, it's just, you know, they've played barely seconds, minutes for Liverpool, and
then they're piling on top of them.
And it looked, but that gave away a lot, didn't it? Because they felt comfortable ruffling his hair and hugging him. He's a father figure amongst the players, and he said beforehand he felt it was his job to make sure anyone who was relatively new having to come into the team because of the number of injuries, it was his role, his job to make sure they felt confident and comfortable and he had their back. And it was important to him to say the right things to them, to encourage them but not overhype them. And I honestly can't think how you could... I'd like you to try, the three of you. Is there something you could say about Van Dijk that he did incorrectly or was a mistake or didn't get quite right during the entire afternoon, including the celebrations? No, I doubt you can.
Tom, you were there. Give it a go. Think of anything.
Well, he headed in a goal when, you know, after a foul, which
was embarrassing. Yeah, he really overly celebrated that when he should have, you know, just kept his powder dry. I think that was a bit embarrassing. Very quickly on the goal, Gregor, just from a defensive point of view on Chelsea's side, I thought it was interesting, the Desai and Mudrick. Is it Mudrick at the front post who's got to attack that ball, or is it has he lost his man?
I think it's a bit of both, but I think it's easier for Desai to lose Van Dijk than it was for Mudrick not just to take a step forward and attack that ball at the right height. Yeah. He waited for it. He was bouncing on his toes. Mm. You know, it was just not a defender sort of instinct. And you saw the despair. I think Chalobah just come on. It's like throwing his hands up. I cannot believe that has just happened. Just finally on, like, there is nothing better than seeing like loads of academy kids getting on the pitch like this. Yeah. It was a joy to watch. And I say this every available opportunity. No matter what club you're at whatever level, it is precious having these guys who stepped up from the academy. It gives like an energy. It energises the experienced players around them. It strengthens the bond between the team and the supporters. It does so much for a team. And the thing that we're kind of overlooking here is, because of Chelsea's £1 billion spend, is that they had a lot of that and they burned it.
Mm.
It's like, that's almost, for me, the biggest travesty in all of this for Chelsea is that they actually have the best academy in the country, or they have had one of them for a long, long time. And for a long time, none of them got a look in, and then when they did, they started flogging them all. It's an absolute travesty.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's slightly the point of our colleague Martin Samuel's piece that you can read on the website now. Liverpool are a true team, Chelsea just an illusion of one. But, and you know, the academy kids is something that a lot of listeners have been in touch with me about, Tony McMullen, and particularly talking about the excitement of seeing that. Tom, linking that to your piece on Chelsea then, because you've said already, and you felt when we were talking after the game, that there were some positives there. But maybe that slightly some of the points in your piece do link to Gregor's idea as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite fashionable, I think, these days for clubs to go against the kind of continuity model. You know, we've seen it work. You know, Chelsea have it's worked for them for a long time, chopping and changing managers every couple of years, you know, windy trophies. Real Madrid have done it, Bayern Munich are doing it now, you know, and you can win silverware that way. But I think what Liverpool is a real testament to is when you have a system, when you have a strategy, a clear plan, a coach that kind of, you know, imbues trust in young players, what it does is it almost takes the emphasis away from the individual youngster, right? So when they come on, you're not thinking, is he good enough? Is he going to play? Can he sort of show his potential? Is he too nervous? They just slot in, you know, they slot in and they know what they've got to do and they understand their role. And he looks like Conor Bradley, you know, I mean, he didn't kind of come on, so I think, and he came off at 70 minutes or something, you know, so. But actually, for the first kind of half an hour, he was the best player on the pitch. Like, he was giving Chilwell absolute, you know, nightmare down that side, you know. And it's that kind of thing where it's not a coincidence that a club like Liverpool, you get a 19-year-old who goes in and just looks like everything's natural, everything's normal. If you have a club like Chelsea, you get these youngsters go in and they look lost, they look like they're disorientated. And that comes from the fact that there's no continuity, not just on the pitch, but off the pitch as well. And I think what Chelsea, you know, you could see yesterday, and I personally have watched Chelsea a fair bit in the last few weeks. Every time I watch them, I think there is something there. Like, there is, you can see players sort of doing good things in moments. And there was a moment yesterday where Cole Palmer kind of played the through ball through to, it must have been Gallagher, I think, and he kind of just dropped to his knees and was almost just sort of praying, like begging him to finish, you know. And there is that kind of sense that there are like four or five players, I think, on the pitch for Chelsea that they can build something around. Pochettino could build something around, but the problem they have is that the whole thing is distracted by three or four players who either aren't good enough, either aren't buying into the culture. And Pochettino is, I mean, if Mudryk was an academy player, he wouldn't be getting the team. He would not be playing.
So he's one of those three or four. Who would the other kind of... Is it more the big spend players that aren't buying into it, do you think?
I think maybe, but you know, in a way it's not. I mean, Pochettino and Chelsea have all the data and they're much better at scouting. It's not for me to kind of say this person, you know, Enzo Fernandez could become the next Luka Modric next season. But for me, I haven't seen it. For 107 million, I look at Modric as a good example. When Real Madrid are up against it, like Chelsea were in the first half an hour yesterday, Modric looks for the ball, goes and gets it, says, I'm in charge here, I'm going to bring this team under control. Fernandes in the first half now yesterday just gave the ball away, just pass away, through ball, given away, hid behind players, didn't want it.
And offered nothing defensively too.
And offered nothing defensively either. And I sort of think, if you're going to be the sort of playmaker in this team and you're going to be 107 million worth, you've got to do more than that, you know. And is Sterling the future for Chelsea? In my opinion, no. Nicholas Jackson, you know, there's sort of five or six players that Pochettino is having to kind of accommodate whilst he's trying to build something. And we all know the financial restrictions that Chelsea have, and ultimately it's probably not possible for them to have a clear out. But it reminds me of, and this is why I wrote in the piece, that it reminds me of Tottenham's second summer. Pochettino gave them a year and he said, okay, you can all have a chance. And then in the second summer, out went Soldado, out went Capu, out went Paulinho, out went Lennon and Townsend, either because they weren't good enough or because they weren't buying into his culture. And it didn't matter how much Spurs had spent on them. They basically said, OK, we're going to back you with the sales. It seems to me that if Chelsea actually want to kind of take the next step and actually make real progress under Pochettino, that's what needs to happen. They need to streamline everything back and say, here's the cluster, we build around them, and the rest, they go. But the problem is they can't afford to do it.
Because, I mean, also, like, if you looked at their team, putting Reece James at right back, you're not far away from their best starting 11 after the £1 billion spend here. It just constantly amazes me that that's the case. And
Alison, do you see...
I honestly think, I've said it before, we'll look back at this as one of the most remarkable sort of and catastrophic spending sprees that there's ever been in the history of football.
Alison, on the more positive side for Chelsea fans, do you agree with some of Tom's points about there being potential there for Pochettino? Because you wrote a piece before this match about Pochettino in finals and, you know, his history at Tottenham and things. Do you see a few seeds of hope?
I'm not sure that I see that.
That
much
was a long
hope.
Pause as
yeah,
well.
Yeah. I think it is very peculiar that whilst I will accept there were some good chances created by Chelsea, they made far, far more errors than the individual Liverpool players did. There was an awful lot of giving the ball away. Lapses in concentration, you might say it was nervousness, and they are a young team. But what's really interesting about this final, when you think about the future of both clubs and whether there's, you know, seeds of hope for Chelsea fans, is that somehow all the youth and inexperience from Liverpool side, there weren't as many errors. Why is that? How can you? And the players that were playing for Chelsea were young, but they had far more experience, and they were starting to look like a team. You know, same names in the same positions. Which hasn't been the case for them, but they did look like they were a recognisable team. This is the Chelsea team, and like Gregor says, this is more or less what you'd expect him to pick first choice. Actually, this is recognisable. This is a team, cost a lot of money, starting to gel. To me, it's worrying that they make so many mistakes and collectively get very introverted very quickly. That this game was there for the taking, even before the Gravenberch injury, which stretched Liverpool even further. It was there for the taking for any decent Premier League team that had confidence in themselves and had the ability to look at how depleted Liverpool were and to say, right, we can be arrogant here, we can be confident, we are the stronger starting 11, we have more depth on the bench, we can go for this. And the fact that Chelsea were unable to do that, go for the jugular, it wasn't just in the extra time period either. There were waves of that insecurity, I think, during the first 90 minutes. And that has to come, surely it has to come, just as we're praising Klopp for instilling an ethos that seeps down to the academy so that when the academy boys come through, they know what's expected and they'll fit in well, both in terms of attitude and style of play. It's not filtering through what, I'm not exactly sure what Pochettino wants from them, because is he telling them to be conservative? And if they have this collective malaise where they become negative and conservative, where's it coming from? I think that's really worrying, that we didn't even see, we should have seen arrogance from Chelsea at Wembley, and we did not.
Almost like they need a Virgil van Dijk. Finally, Tom, on Jurgen Klopp, obviously a huge part of this story and a huge part of the day. What was he like in the press conference afterwards? Was he full of the joys as he was showing out on the pitch, or was he a bit more measured?
He was quite emotional, I thought. Very emotional. And he sort of insisted that it was nothing to do with him. He was quite keen to say, you know, I couldn't care less about my legacy. It's not because this might be my last appearance at Wembley. But I felt like there was a real sense of emotion for him, you know. And he said it was his most special trophy of his career. And, you know, he's won, I don't know, 15 odd or something, you know. And you sort of think, well, Carabao Cup, you know, compared to some of the other ones. But I can kind of see that, you know. I think he really felt that because of the kids, I think he felt this was a real sort of club trophy, you know, that it was, he mentioned the staff and the kids. And, okay, we hear this in a lot of kind of victory speeches, but I really think he meant it, that this was something for the academy. It was for the kind of the fans and the sort of people of Liverpool. And he was emotional. I mean, he was, it surprised me, actually. He looked kind of exhausted and he kept on telling people that they didn't have to ask more questions because he'd already answered a lot. But, yeah, I mean, I guess this is the kind of the beginning of the kind of Klopp farewell tour. It could be a quadruple, maybe. But I think it was a very special win for him. You know, you could sense that in the way he was talking.
Definitely. It won't be the last time we discuss the Jurgen Klopp farewell tour on this podcast this season. So we're going to move on. And before that thrilling Carabao Cup final, there was an equally thrilling game, I jest, between Wolves and Sheffield United. So thrilling, in fact, that I'm only going to ask one question about it, and that's to you, Gregor Robertson. And it's about scrapping teammates. Souza and Robinson having a little tete-a-tete, should we say. And all I want to know is, give us the ruling. Does this show anything? Does this mean anything? Does this sum up Sheffield United's season? Or is it actually just completely fine for two footballers to have a go at each other on the pitch?
I don't think it means that much. I think Chris Wilder said it. He said it happens three or four times a year in training or in the dressing room. When it happens on the pitch, obviously it underlines the sense of frustration that they're feeling, and it's a miserable, miserable season for Sheffield United. That's why it's relatively rare. But I don't think it actually means anything.
Another good win for Wolves fans, and they climb up the table. But we're going to move on as well, because I just want to finish part one with a bit of insight into how the things work on the desk between editors and writers. So all these guys work incredibly hard over the weekend and go to matches on Saturdays and Sundays. And if you're at a match on a Saturday, and if, like me, you're in charge on the Sunday, you wait with bated breath for the emails and calls to come in from our writers. What's their idea going to be? What they're going to talk about for their piece the following day? And an email dropped into my inbox at 11:15 on Saturday night, Hi, Tom. Just back from the Vitality. Full of Vitality. Ovs. I think we know who this is from, don't we? A piece on Pep, oh my God, Guardiola. And how he said facing Brentford in midweek was like a trip to the dentist without anaesthetic. Alison Rudd.
Deal.
Deal. 800 words, please. Tell us more about Pep and his trip to the dentist.
I find him very hard to... I mean, he made it clear, didn't he, quite recently. He thinks journalists aren't really up to much. I have a better life than you, he said.
So is that not more like the kind of the fun of what, you know, Tom was having with Jurgen Klopp yesterday? Or is it a different thing, do you think?
I just think he genuinely thinks we're pretty rubbish, to be honest. He sat facing the media. They'd got to within a point of Liverpool. Most managers in that situation would want to convey this sense of, look out, Liverpool, we're right on your tail, and have some element of, I don't know, some glint in their eye, something. He looked very, very bored to be there. He spent the entire time watching the TV on the wall because Arsenal were playing, which I think is bad manners, actually. If you're talking to someone, you should be looking at them. And then I concluded his mood was partly because his team, whilst being, you know, superior as normal, we're quite lucky that Bournemouth didn't have anyone who could score, and that because Bournemouth were very brave and played very well. But partly because I assumed he really didn't enjoy having played Brentford on Tuesday night, and he said it was like going to the dentist, a trip to the dentist without anaesthetic, which is a huge compliment to Brentford, and I hope they absorb that and go
They're
on and
a
win
lot
every
of those
game.
Compliments.
They do. I mean, managers hate playing them. Klopp hates playing them. But they're not getting the points, despite making it feel like a trip to the dentist. So it boiled down to the gripe being that he's got too many games to play. But you know, successful teams do. I can only assume he must have had all his wisdom teeth out.
Tom, you agree with that? Pep Guardiola in press conferences.
Yeah,
or does he just not like Alisson?
I think he doesn't like Alisson, that's for sure. But I think managers tend to kind of divide into two. I either think they think the journalists are just a complete waste of time and therefore every question just needs to be kind of battered away as quickly as possible. Or they sort of think that journalists do know stuff and therefore they're kind of a bit suspicious and wary of them. And I sort of think this sort of new wave of like Arteta is like this as well, right? In press conferences, you ask him a question and he sort of immediately kind of gives little side eyes if, what on earth are you talking about? You know, and then he gives you sort of eight words and then wants to get on to the next one.
So he's from the Pep school?
He's from the Pep school, yeah, right. I think. And then there's sort of other managers who are more kind of wary, like Moyes, I think. You know, he sort of suspects you maybe know stuff and as a result, he's a bit more wary. So, whereas Pep just thinks you know nothing. You know?
Although Moyes can be really old school too. Like when sometimes when you kind of shift to the from the broadcast to the newspaper section, you're like, I mean, when I was doing the European
So just to explain that season. For listeners, right? It's broken into two sections.
Yeah,
so there's the TV people.
Yeah, it's filmed and it's all quite formal. And then afterwards, there's like an embargoed section for the written press. And sometimes Moyes will like sit on a table and like everyone surrounds him and he kind of holds court and he looks like he enjoys himself. So he's quite old school as well. But he can flip from one to the other. And the one thing I'd say about Pep is the fact that he looks like he hates it so much means that on the occasions when he really says something like impactful, it's double impactful. You know, like when he's really passionate or he says, I love my team today, or when he says the opposite, he said that last season, remember, this is not the team I know. And everybody's like, wow. So I think you just got to take the rough with the smooth. These are all different characters. And how many like commitments, how much would people want of Pep's time? It must be exhausting. Like Jurgen Klopp said the same. I remember I went to the game at the start of the season and he had 14 broadcast, individual broadcast interviews before he even got to the written press. Mm. My God. So, yeah, I don't blame them sometimes. And every 3 days.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm sure. But some managers do manage to pull off that sense that they're not bored out their skulls.
Who does? Who have you had in your career that you've always thought, oh, he's giving me the respect of me doing my job?
Well, as a journalist, the managers always stand out are the ones who, no matter what the question is, they will always answer it and answer it properly. So Arsene Wenger, didn't matter how bonkers the question was, how left field the question was, he would always give a full and proper answer. It might sound like he wasn't very entertained, but his actual words were thought through and intelligent.
Thomas Frank's
amazing like that, yeah.
Always. Yeah. Always.
And we'll often say, thoughtful. Oh, good question.
Good question.
Yeah, often like really, really thoughtful answers.
Oh, that's nice. Maybe I should start that. Good answer. Well done, everyone. there you go. Well, I hope you enjoyed that little insight into the journalistic practices, listeners. If you've got views on the pod, and I know lots of you do, rest assured, lots of your excellent ideas are in the pipeline for quiet weeks to come. But do keep them coming. tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. Up next, we're talking Crystal Palace and wondering what's the point of Anthony.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and today I'm joined by Alison Rudd, Tom Allnutt and Gregor Robertson. Now, for Manchester United fans, it had all looked so bloody good. Four wins on the bounce, talk of a top four charge, Rasmus Højlund in the goals and looking great, and even a Thursday episode of the Game Podcast full of praise for the ambition of Jim Ratcliffe and the team's recent form, which pleased listener Barry Lucas so much, who got in touch to say, "I loved listening to you talk about Manchester United in a positive way." Sorry, Barry, switch off now, because we've got a defeat against Fulham to bring you back down to earth, which I'd say that narrative of what I just outlined and then losing at home to Fulham is exactly where Manchester United are at the moment. So that kind of sums up their problems. But I wanted to discuss Paul Hurst's piece today, which you can read on the Times website, which has got, I would say, a very good headline. And I say that not because I did it myself, but well done to our production team. 85 million, 55 seconds, one touch. What is the point of Anthony? Now, Gregor Robertson, I'm going to come to you because old Anthony does lead us back to Erik ten Hag and criticisms of him, and is a man you've defended, not Anthony, Erik ten Hag. It doesn't look great when you're kind of depleted and Rasmus Højlund, as we say, in great form, is then injured and you don't turn to your second most expensive signing ever.
Yeah, first of all, I also think it's slightly harsh that we're talking about Anthony when he had one touch and Man United got beat 2-1.
But the point is, he should have had more. The point is, of Paul Hurst's piece, is that he should have been on the start.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, your leader. You know, we've talked this podcast about you've got leaders and whether you've got overpaid flops, and I think we know which category he's heading towards.
He is. And look, he's also said he's been affected by some of the stuff that's going on off the pitch. But it's also, like we've said it before, it's just indicative of the mess that Manchester United have been in for so long that this is also going to be a stick to beat Ten Hag with, because he's very much a Ten Hag signing. And look, that's the thing that all Manchester United fans can hope, well, there's just going to be no more of moving forward. It's not going to be a decision that kind of rests with the manager and the manager alone. There's going to be some more joined up thinking going on. But they are now shackled with some really expensive looking flops. And it's very hard to see a way out of it for Anthony,
yeah.
Like a positive way out of it. You could in theory see Jadon Sancho returning, and maybe under a new manager flourishing.
Mm.
But there's just been very, very little to suggest that Anthony was worth even half the money that Manchester United spent on.
Well, just as also to make a point that we're not the only ones critical of Manchester United on this podcast. Chris Wright on the Times website, in the comments section underneath Paul Hurst's piece, this is Sir Jim's number one priority: sort out and get rid of the overpaid, overpriced dross. As it is clear that Ten Hag wanted Anthony, don't allow him to any final choice on future transfers. That's if he has a future at all. And that was part of our conversation on Thursday, wasn't it, Gregor, where you and James Gearbrand in particular cheekily hinted that maybe Jim Ratcliffe would be thinking about other managers. Thomas Tuchel was mentioned. Tom, I wanted to get your take on that idea? Because this defeat does heap the pressure back on Erik ten Hag, doesn't it? We all got excited. We all thought they might be charging to the top four. This puts the pressure and the spotlight back on him.
Yeah, it does. It was interesting. I was in Amsterdam 2 or 3 weeks ago to check in on Jordan Henderson's debut. And although mainly I was asking people about Henderson, I did sort of just for curiosity really speak to some people about what they thought about the sort of Ten Hag situation and Anthony. And their view was that basically Ajax couldn't believe the amount of money that Man United paid for him. I mean, they sort of said, yeah, he's a talented player and he showed some good signs, but he was sort of in a group of some players that may or may not go to a big Premier League club. Like, there was no sense that he was going to be worth that amount of money. And the other thing that people sort of said was that with Ten Hag, although they rate him very highly in Amsterdam, they did say that the one thing with Ten Hag was that he was always quite clearly a very good coach, you know, a very good sort of pragmatic mind who was very focused on the things that he did very well, his small details and his kind of areas of interest, they sort of said, you know, he was very good on. But at Ajax at that point, not so much now, but 3 or 4 years ago, Ajax had a very good kind of system club where everyone knew their roles. They had, you know, good sporting director, etc. And it seems to me now that the Anthony question is kind of linked to this, where ultimately if you give maybe Ten Hag more authority and power than perhaps he deserves, or at least can manage, then maybe that's not his area of strength, you know, and that's where these two things kind of combine almost. I mean, I think if Ten Hag was in a club where everything was right, if you put Ten Hag at Manchester City, for example, I think he would probably do a pretty good job. You know, he knows how to manage a team, you know, and he knows how to create a decent style of play. But if you ask him to do more than that, you know, then no. So I think what they have to decide in the summer is, are they going to kind of build this thing around a manager, or are they going to build the off-field first and then slot in a coach? And if they're going to do the second thing and they believe in that enough, then actually Ten Hag, I don't think, is a bad choice. You know, if you look around Europe, there aren't, you know, loads of really dynamic up-and-coming coaches that have a better record than Ten Hag. But if they think they need a manager with a bit more authority and charisma who's actually going to bring through, you know, some of that other stuff off the field, almost the reverse engineering, then they're going to need someone else. And maybe that's where someone like Tuchel will come in. But this summer's going to be complicated. The managerial market is going to be pretty hot. You know, you've got Bayern looking, you've got Liverpool looking, Barcelona looking. Are Manchester United ahead of those three these days? I mean, I don't know. They're not ahead of Bayern. If you're an up-and-coming manager, I don't think they'd be ahead of Bayern. They're definitely not ahead of Liverpool. Barcelona have sort of had their own obvious problems, but, you know, they might have to take the kind of third or fourth pick, not the first.
Alison, what do you make of...
Well, it's not looking good for Ten Hag, precisely for that reason. That he came in deliberately with a lot of authority. If you remember when he came in, it was, here's a man who's got the strength of character to cope with all the off-field problems at Old Trafford. It's not, there's a lot going wrong there. We need a very strong individual. And he was given the power to have this say in transfers and the running of the entire club. He was more than just a technical coach, which seemed odd given that's exactly what he was good at, was being a technical coach. And so now you've solved those off-field problems in theory with the arrival of the Radcliffe consortium. So why would they stick with someone who was only appointed to cope with the problems they now themselves think they should solve? It doesn't make any sense at all. And I think it's just so interesting. I'm sure it was like almost Freudian that you mentioned the word charisma, because he does... There was a point in commentary for the game against Fulham where I can't remember who was commentating, but the camera panned to Ten Hag and the commentator said, "Oh, Ten Hag looks furious." And I thought, he looked exactly the same 20 minutes earlier. And in the game they won, you know, he looks exactly the same. Like, he doesn't project any sense of connection between him and the players, that if they wanted to look towards the bench for some encouragement, they're not going to get any. If I was Sir Jim, I would be thinking, I just want a different type of manager.
If you were Sir Jim Radcliffe taking over the club, when did he join? 2 years ago? Whatever.
Ten Hag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, at that point in history, and you were looking for a new head coach to fit into your new sort of vision, he might have been the man, but there's too much water sometimes passes under the bridge and everything. You know, he has history with the players. He has quite a lot of kind of the same sort of peaks and troughs that Manchester United have endured for many, many years. He's not really done anything to change that. So I'd be surprised to see him survive past the
summer. But well done, Fulham.
Well, exactly. You jumped in before the every podcast host catchphrase. We have to mention Fulham. We have to mention slightly smaller team beating big team away, because as much as this sums up Manchester United's season, this very much
encapsulates Fulham's season. They did not have Paulinho, Fulham's season, their best player.
But they wanted it more, according to Calvin Bassey.
They did not have Willian, arguably also their best player. And they did not have Jimenez, their, arguably their best striker. I mean, they were bereft. I often worry about Fulham without Paulinho. What will they be? Because he's so phenomenal. And Willian is that dashing energy, even though he's very old. He just dashes everywhere and upsets defenders. And they were without them. And yet they still, through confidence, knowing their system, that just... I mean, they should have won this by 4 or 5 goals. It was
excellent
amazing
winner.
That they weren't.
Excellent winner
ahead.
By Iwobi as well, wasn't it? It's like pure composure.
And Muniz is a great story.
He's started to come good. Yeah.
He's really emerging as, like, he had a disastrous loan spell at Middlesbrough last season. All the time that Fulham have needed a striker, they kind of not really want to look at him, and now he's come in. And it's not just the fact that he scored some goals. He's a really kind of bustling, hard-working, difficult to play against sort of centre forward. I think watched Fulham last week and I thought he was brilliant. I think he's a really good story. And obviously, you know, Jimenez looked like he was going to be a really good story stepping into finally returned to some of the form that he had before he fractured his skull. Then he got an injury, and I mean, he's just stepping up. So they've actually got some good attacking options now. Iwobi's a brilliant player. You watch Iwobi and you think, if he'd stuck around at Arsenal, at his best, there's no reason why he couldn't be a player that they would have continued to use.
I honestly think, for full context, I once said to my friends that I thought he was a great signing and good value when he moved to Everton, and they literally never let me forget it. And so when Alex Iwobi does anything good, it's fantastic.
I didn't even tee you up for that. People will think I'm mad for saying that, but I think he's really, really versatile and a major threat when he's at his best. I know it's being at his best has been the issue. And he joined a bit of a basket case in Everton, and he was playing right wing back. Now he's playing in a sort of more advanced role, and he's been outstanding.
Excellent point, Gregor. Have that, lads. How do you like me now? Anyway, moving on, we're talking about managers and big performances and big results at the weekend. And Gregor, you were at Crystal Palace to see a big performance and a big result for a new manager, Oliver Glasner. But it wasn't necessarily the man in the dugout who caught your eye. It was another man on the pitch.
Well, he did. I mean, Glasner, I said in the piece already, there's like a clear blueprint.
Already? Well, what would you say that blueprint is?
I say already because it was there against Everton, even though he wasn't in the dugout. He'd only been appointed a few hours earlier. He was sitting in the stands watching it. But for the first time in about 18 months, they played a back three. And so it's a 3-4-2-1. The wing-backs, Mitchell and Munoz, pushed really high. And I kind of...
What do you think of Munoz, by the way? Because I thought he looked like a really good, fun, barrelling, almost sort of like 90s footballer.
Absolutely. Yeah, he looks like he's better suited to this than playing in a back four or Tyrick Mitchell. Tyrick Mitchell's great, and, you know, I was writing this and reminded that he earned 2 England caps under Patrick Vieira when he was liberated a little bit more to attack. So there's hope that he will return to some of that form, but he's not as comfortable as Munoz. And Munoz, before the sending off, was probably Palace's best attacking player. But the player who kind of underlined the dawning of a new era was Matthias Franca, who only played for 24 minutes. But he came on 2 minutes late. 2 minutes after he came on, Chris Richards scored the first goal. 5 minutes after he came on, he linked brilliantly with Mitchell, flashed the ball across, got his first assist for the club. And then another 5 minutes after that, he ran half a length of the pitch, won the penalty from which Palace scored the third. And he was in a very quiet summer. They're one kind of key signing, and you know, 19-year-old Brazilian for 20-odd million quid. There was a lot of excitement about him, probably too much expectation put on his shoulders for such a young lad. And he'd only played like 92 minutes in substitute appearances before. Before he started against Chelsea, because they were down to the bare bones recently, and they've not seen much of him. But this was the day that his sort of Palace career took flight, and that coinciding with a new manager's first game, and although Alison may not like to hear this, the sort of suggestion that under Roy Hodgson there was never really a kind of a path to successful first team football for a lot of really promising young kids that Palace have. Yes, you can talk about Elise and Eze, but they already had a bank of experience and kind of known quality there before they were given their opportunity. The Palace have a lot of young players who the fans have wanted to see for a long, long time, and they haven't really been given either the opportunity or a team to sort of flourish in, and you know, a bit more attack minded. And I think we're seeing that. Although this was a sort of organised shape, they played much higher up the pitch. I know they were playing against 10-man Burnley, but they did that against Everton too. So I think it's a really positive start, really positive first week for Oliver Glasner.
We were talking about press conference demeanours. What was he like to talk to after?
He's good. He's really calm and composed, and you know, can crack a little joke. He said before the game that he's not a magician, he's not David Copperfield. And then he was asked about, you know, he pulled a rabbit out of the hat with his substitute afterwards, and he said, no, Adam Wharton's probably David Copperfield, because he's the one you had to pull him off because he looked like he was going to get sent off. So he was like, if he hadn't done that, then...
But he also looks like quite a good signing.
Wharton, absolutely. I was thinking about, until he got dragged, I was thinking, there's probably a piece, this might have been your email in the evening. In another Palace, I've got a really good track record in dipping into the Championship and signing the best players that are there and giving them a platform. And he's actually said that's why he picked Palace. He saw Elise and Eze, and you could even throw Gahey into that, who's played on loan and stuff. He saw how they were given a chance, and that's why he said he agreed to come to Palace. And he's made a really, really good start as well.
It's a good job, Palace, I think. You know, there's a lot of upside for a new manager. They've got, if you kind of come into a new job, what are the kind of things you immediately need to sort of get yourself on side with the fans? You know, he can overturn the style of football almost immediately, you know, and that's kind of what happened recently at Spurs, you know, just the immediate kind of sense, sort of a breath of relief almost, you know, we can see us creating chances, we're trying to win the game suddenly, you know. And the other thing, they've got a really good group of young players, you know, and if Hodgson wasn't prepared to maybe trust them as much, you know, he can get a lot of immediate credit by putting more trust in them. And I think we've said before, this season is a good season, I think, to for these kind of mid-table clubs to almost roll the dice a bit. And I like the fact Palace now have a new manager. They've got, you know, two or three months now where they can kind of bed him in. He can look at the squad before the summer. And Glasner's pretty demanding in the market. We've seen him before at his previous clubs. He doesn't sort of just roll over and say, OK, I'll work with what I've got. You know, he'll want good signings. And then they can hit next season. And, you know, they've got a lot of games under their belt with a new coach, whereas there are probably two or three teams in the Premier League are going to be starting from scratch in the summer.
Wasn't anybody slightly disappointed that we now don't have the situation where Glasner loses his first four games and they have to phone Roy Hodgson to come back for the last spurt of the season to save them?
It would have been funny. It would have been definitely funny.
Next season.
Probably not funny for Palace fans, sorry, I should
no,
say.
God, no, God.
We've got a lot of colleagues on the sports desk who would definitely not agree with that being funny. We're going to end with a chat about Arsenal. I was watching this game in a pub, and there was a wonderful, wonderful... It was wonderful to watch the whole game because there was a couple sat right in front of the screen, and they were just so excited watching this, and they were kind of shouting, I knew he was going to score, I told you he was good, and they're kind of like holding hands and then jumping every time he scored. And it kind of, this is what Arsenal have become for their fans. They, for so long, they were quite frustrating, and maybe they still might not win any trophies, but the way they're playing at the minute is so front foot and exciting, isn't it, Tom? The way, because this is, you know, they talk about this before the game about having their feathers ruffled by Newcastle in the past, and Arteta was saying, oh, I need to be prepared for the gamesmanship. But they just completely smothered them in every sense, didn't they?
Yeah, they're flying Arsenal. You know, the last four or five games, they've been absolutely brilliant. They're scoring loads of goals. Saka has just looks transformed. Ever since that break, what was it, in January, was it, where they kind of had a couple of weeks and went off to Dubai or whatever it was, he's come back and he looks like the real kind of Saka of old. And I think in that kind of sticky period that Arsenal had, there was a real sense that their front two or three players just weren't firing. But they look like they're really singing again now. And I think, I mean, maybe the comparison with Newcastle was a little bit unfair, because I don't feel like this Newcastle at the moment is anything like the Newcastle before, you know, that we saw last season, with the defence is just, it's folded. They're nowhere near as niggly and tough to beat anymore. And that's a separate issue. But I think Arsenal, the only thing with Arsenal is, are they peaking too early? You know, they're kind of flying right now in February. I think, like, you know, when's the dip coming? You know,
but they've had a dip. Maybe they've had their dip. They didn't have the dip. They only had one last season, and it was right at the end. Maybe they had their little pre-Christmas dip, that West Ham defeat, and now they're just going to fly all the way to the title.
Yeah. I mean, I had them as winning the title when we did our, what was it, our top four predictions or whatever, and I think I was the only one, and I felt pretty stupid, because then they went on that terrible run, and I was hoping that no one would read my bit at the bottom of that piece. But now I'm feeling more confident. I mean, I also think, it, you know, it could suit them, just sort of hanging off the shoulder, you know, in the last kind of last 100 metres, last 200 metres. I don't think they want to be in front. They don't want to be ahead of Liverpool and City, and just kind of let the Klopp hype kind of drive, you know, everything that's going on at Liverpool, let the sort of City thing roll. And then if they're just kind of in the mix, I think, with four or five games to go, then they can try and nick it. But they've got some tough games. They've still got to go to Spurs, Arsenal. They've got to play away at United, I think. They've got to play City, haven't they? So there are still some big games for them to come, but they're right there.
I think they're up to 19 set pieces now. Like, that's
you told them, mate. You told them.
If you've got that and the best defence in the league, they've got a chance.
Yeah.
Opens games up. Worried about. Take the leads if they, like, you know, it can win games for them.
Worried about Arsenal?
Not at all. No. Although I do think Saliba's close to Virgil.
Interesting. Wow, that is high praise. Goodness me, Neil, clip that up as well for the future.
Close.
Close is pretty good given what you think about Virgil van Dijk. Newcastle, Gregor, because Tom hinted at it there with some of his kind of descriptions. They're slightly just kind of tailing away a little bit. Is this a worry for Eddie Howe? You know, we're talking about Erik ten Hag and owners looking at the future and planning for the summer. Is this a bit of a worry? He was obviously, they're brilliant last season. This season hasn't been as good, and this performance, as much as Arsenal were brilliant, they, I thought they were dismal, Newcastle, in that, particularly in that first half.
Yeah. I mean, the way it's the ease with which they're being played through now, it's that's kind of striking. And the thing that Eddie Howe and Newcastle need to get back to, like the number of times you see a ball played sort of over the top or in behind, and Kieran, the back four is not. It used to be such a well regimented, drilled line. You know, they would repel everything, or they would play them offside. Kieran Trippi was, I think, for the first or second goal, he was like far too deep. There's none of that coherence in the back four. It used to be so settled as well, and it has been chopping and changing this year because of injuries. But there's that, and then just seems to be a lack of protection in front of them as well. So. I'm still inclined to give Arsenal all the credit, though, because you're right, the word to use is, you know, they suffocated them. They just pressed them to death. And any sort of like slightly underhit pass across the back four, or, you know, the player never had a time to take a touch and open up and play forward. It was always just like they were on top of them immediately. So I feel inclined to give most of the credit to Arsenal.
Yeah, James has written his piece from that match talking about Jorginho and being a bit of an unsung hero. That was a bit of a problem for them at the start of the season, trying to work out how to release Odegaard, work out which of the roles Rice suited best. Does it matter, Tom? Or should they kind of settle, talking about being in this run, talking about keeping it going, talking about not having a dip? Does it matter? Should they just keep chopping and changing, bring Jorginho in, or should he get a consistent run now alongside Rice?
No, I mean, I think one of the problems last year was that Arteta had a really settled team, and actually he needed to have more rotations, you know, and I think that is something that Arsenal have. Okay, they don't have the depth, I don't think the City have, probably don't even have the depth that Liverpool have, but I think they do have more options there. And when they signed Rice, the idea was not that he would just sort of be a kind of holding pivot destroyer. They wanted him to be more of a kind of number eight box to box. They had this idea, they'd seen what he'd done at West Ham, and that he could be a more all-round midfielder, and we're seeing that, you know, not just in his kind of goals and assists, but also he's taking set pieces, and, you know, he's much more of an all-round midfielder. For Jorginho, I mean, we interviewed him, must have been in December time, I think, and it was all about this thing, you know, that Jorginho can speak loads of languages. He kind of, like, is great with the kids. Not as in the kids. That sounds like he's great with his kids. Great with the young players.
He's a great dad.
And a real kind of tactical brain. Like, apparently just loves all the kind of stuff that Arteta sort of tells him. He's very good on the pitch, you know, understanding things quickly and transmitting that to his teammates. And I think there is a role there. I mean, Jorginho has limitations, and no doubt about that, and we shouldn't, you know, overplay. I think in certain games he, you know, is not suited, but I think as a kind of overall club presence at Arsenal, I think he's been really important this season.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely an important presence. But speaking of tactics and being tactical geniuses, we're going to finish with a mention for George Ellacobi, our friend our friend on this podcast, and I'm sure if you've listened to Alison Rudd's excellent special episode from last Friday, if you haven't, you've still time. You can still go back and listen to it now. Alison, have you got your shirt ready for tonight against Coventry? You're going to be watching on? You'll be in the director's box, won't you?
I do hope they... I mean, if you win in life because of the effort you put in, then Maidstone should beat Coventry, because I was absolutely shocked when George Ellacobe detailed how he'd prepared for Ipswich. And I think I said something like, let's just get what in my written piece, I said, let's get this out of the way. It was not pure luck. They trucked up to Ipswich and hoped they'd get lucky. He hired a pitch and he, because they train on 3G at Maidstone. And of course, he goes to Portman Road. It's a grass pitch. So he hired a grass pitch and he measured it out exactly the Portman Road dimensions, not as a sort of bit of a joke or something. He wanted his players to know the spaces they'd have to fill when they were defending and what room they'd have in which to attack on the break. He knew it would always be the break, and he practiced wave after wave of attack because he knew that's what it would be like. He analysed the Ipswich subs because he knew it would be a second string team that they'd be facing. And he created chaos when they were in training because he knew it would be extra hard and they'd all have more than one job to, every player would have more than one job to do. And that is how it unfolded at Ipswich. The players did step up and they did work harder than they'd ever worked before, but he trained them for that. And when they got the breaks, they capitalised because they were calm under pressure because they'd prepared for it. And let's not forget, you know, this is a team sixth in the pyramid on the rung. You know, they're way, way down. So if you, and he's doing that with players who aren't full-time players, it is amazing. So he'll have done the same thing. He'll have hired a pitch, measured out the same dimensions, and he will go to Coventry. Honestly, he'll go there as prepared as a team in the National League South could be.
A win for the grafters, hopefully. Sorry, Coventry fans, you have to be the bad guys this time. Good luck to Maidstone. Alison Rudd, Tom Allnutt and Gregor Robson, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you too for listening. We'll be back on Thursday, maybe discussing a Maidstone win and the rest of the FA Cup action.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.